It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Dells, it has attracted visitors for over a century, drawn to the natural beauty of its sandstone bluffs. Tourism drives the economy generations later. Its Visitors and Convention Bureau says direct tourist spending last year added up to nearly $1.4 billion. Call in with your questions and comments about the Dells, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Melanie Redzicki McManus is author of the new book called 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. Melanie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. How did Wisconsin Dells become such an epicenter of tourism in South Central Wisconsin?
Well, it started more than 100 years ago when a photographer named H.H. Bennett started taking photos of the Dells formations that line the Wisconsin River. And he was good at marketing, and he got the photos out there across the nation, and people just started coming to see the natural beauty of the Dells. And this was the late 1800s. And as tourism picked up and we got into the 20th century, we got more and more attractions in the Dells. And today it's actually known internationally as a great center, mostly for the water parks, but also again for the natural beauty.
And you can even go to H.H. Bennett's studio and do some things there. What would you suggest?
In his studio?
Yes, because isn't the studio is also a place where you can tour?
Yes, it's one of our state historic sites. One of the things I like the most about going inside the studio is there is the rug has a setup of the distance. There's a famous jump that H.H. Bennett's son Ashley did onto a sandstone rock formation, kind of a pillar standing apart. And that is reenacted by a dog jumping today. And you can go in the museum and stand on the floor, and they have marked the exact distance where his son Ashley had made this jump, and the dog jumps now. So you can test yourself to see what it would be like, to see if you would be able to jump that distance. So that's kind of an interesting part. But you can also see a lot of H.H. Bennett's original equipment. You can see his photographs. He did a lot of work with the Native Ho-Chunk people, and there's a lot of information about their history as well. So it's really a worthwhile stop.
And so there is a Trojan horse, 65-foot Trojan horse on Wisconsin Dells Parkway. Why is it there? What is that about?
Well, if you know the Dells at all, it's a curious mixture of the natural beauty and maybe more traditional activities like miniature golf, but they have a lot of outrageous curiosities as well. One of them is, the giant Trojan horse, which I'm oddly fascinated with, but it's part of Mount Olympus Park, and there's a go-kart that runs right through the belly of the Trojan horse. And the owner of Mount Olympus is a man named Nick Lascaris, and he has a Greek background, which is why the place is called Mount Olympus, and there's a Trojan horse there. But it's definitely one of those icons of Wisconsin Dells Parkway.
Just go with it, right? Just go with it.
Exactly.
Let's take a call now. Eugene in Viola. Eugene, hi.
Good morning. If you're going to visit the Dells, if you go all the way through the Wisconsin Dells, you go north about a quarter of a mile, you'll see a sign that says Camp Wabeek. It's an Easter Seal camp for the physically handicapped. There's 500 acres up there. They start with the children in the spring of the year, and they wind up with adults in the late summer. The land was donated by some daughters of a millionaire lawyer to build a castle up there. And you name it, and they've got the recreational facilities for the people who come there, and it's well worth visiting.
Thank you so much for bringing that to our attention, Camp Wabeek. Do you have things to add there, Melanie?
You know, that is actually something I have not heard about yet, and which is one thing I like about the Dells. It's always, there's just so much there, and it's always changing. Now, Camp Wabeek has been there for quite a while, as the caller mentioned, but you can always find something new and interesting to check out.
Talking with Melanie Redzicki McManus about her new book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. And you can add to this list. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Melanie, you have recommendations for animal encounters like giraffes and deer. Where can we see these animals?
There's a wonderful place called Wisconsin Deer Park that's right on Wisconsin Dells Parkway. It's one of my favorite places. You can't see it too much from the road, and it might not sound too enticing, but when you go in, there are all sorts of deer that are just wandering around freely that can eat from your hand if you can buy certain healthy treats for them. And they do have some other animals that are enclosed as well, but it's really a wonderful spot with children or even as an adult. I highly recommend that.
And then there are the duck boats, which I don't know why
yes.
they qualify under animals here, but give us some of the history of the duck boats and how they became famous in the Wisconsin Dells.
Well, the duck boats are amphibious craft. They can go both on land and water, and they were used in World War II on the D-Day landing. And some of the natives in the Dells were one of the first people after World War II when these vehicles were surplus to say, hey, you know what? I think it would be fun to buy one of these, bring it to Wisconsin Dells, and turn it into some kind of a tourist attraction. So that's what happened in the late 1940s. Wisconsin Dells was one of the first places to take one of these duck boats and turn it into a tourist attraction, showcasing both the land and the water in the Dells. So that's something to be proud of, I think, here in Wisconsin. There's a lot of innovation in the Dells and things that have been adopted by other places around the nation. So it's just really exciting to have something like that.
And you have kid-friendly options as well. I know my kids love the duck boats, but there's trampoline park and, of course, the water parks. What would you say is the best kid-centered activity for adults also to participate in?
It really depends on the age of your children. There are certain entertainment spots and resorts that are geared more towards, say, the 8 and under age group of kids. Like Knuckleheads Park, that's geared more set. Great Wolf Lodge is geared more toward the younger. If you've got, say, middle schoolers or high schoolers, there are other attractions where just the height requirements, for example, are for older children. They're more thrilling rides. So there's a wide variety. So for some of the older kids, for sure, well, Noah's Ark has both attractions for young and old, but that's a place where you could get some of the more thrilling rides. And same with the rest of the water parks. Most of them do have a good mixture.
Do you have any tips for trying to visit these water parks when they're less busy and not so crowded with the lines?
Definitely. People tend to go out to eat around the dinner time. And I'm thinking here more for the resorts that have their indoor and outdoor water parks. So that's always a good time to go. The middle of the week, if you're talking Noah's Ark or some of the outdoor ones, Wednesday tends to be a slower day because a lot of people make a long weekend. So say Thursday, Friday, Monday, those days might be busy. It's also, if you don't mind being a little chilly, we have often gone with our family on days when it's maybe 68 or 70, or even if it's a little cloudy, it actually feels good then to be in the water on the water slides because you'll feel warmer in the water than out of the water, but the crowds will be way less on a cooler day or a cloudy day than on a nice, hot, sunny day. You don't have to worry as much about sunburn either.
Mm-hmm. Melanie Redzicki-McManus is the author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. And you could be part of this conversation about the Dells. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin Dells is home to more than 200 water slides, according to its Visitors and Convention Bureau. A new book gives us a fuller picture of the attractions that draw people to this vacation hub on the Wisconsin River. Melanie Redzicki McManus is author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. Let's go to Jen in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to encourage people to consider Devil's Lake. It's only about 20 minutes from the Dells, and it's a beautiful natural lake with lots of camping of all ages, and people can actually climb a beautiful bluff there. The name escapes me, but it's right in the park over the lake, and the scenes from that bluff are just incredible, and the bluff, you know, variable abilities can climb the bluff. And so there's a lot. It's also a natural lake with no motorboats, so it's very quiet, canoeing, kayaking. I would encourage people to go midweek because the weekends are quite busy. But my husband and I met there in 1979, and we've still been married for 42 years.
Do you go back together?
Absolutely. We've taken our children many times, and they grew up loving camping probably because of Devil's Lake.
Oh, Jen, thank you so much for sharing that story. Melanie, go ahead.
Oh, Devil's Lake is a wonderful spot. It's Wisconsin's most visited state park. And yes, it's just 20 minutes south. It's in Baraboo, and the Dells markets itself. Its marketing area includes Baraboo and Devil's Lake. And there is so much in that area, Baraboo as well. So I agree. I highly recommend that. And I'm going to have to put in a plug here. Because I'm a big hiker and backpacker, the Ice Age National Scenic Trail is one of just 11 national scenic trails in the nation. And it's 1,200 miles are all in Wisconsin. And it does run through Devil's Lake. And it even goes through Baraboo and around the Dells area. So I'm always trying to encourage people who are in the Dells and enjoy nature and the beautiful river and sandstone formations to also check out the National Scenic Trail, the Ice Age Trail, and do a little hike on it.
What season would you recommend for hiking there for the most magnificent views?
Definitely the fall.
The fall.
You hike there with the fall foliage, which now, of course, is just all fallen off. But that is by far the most beautiful time. The temperatures are good. There are few bugs, no ticks. It's just really a lovely time.
Let's go to Stuart in West Dallas. Stuart, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Hi, so I'm an avid canoer. I've canoed the Wisconsin River from Lac Vieux des Airs to where it connects in the Mississippi. And I've noticed that the most hard or most dangerous stretch for canoers and kayakers is actually the Dells. Commercial tour boats, they don't really pay attention to other recreational users. And multiple times I've had wakes tip my boat because they just don't seem to care.
Do you find there's more congestion as you go through that area?
There's more engine for sure, but I noticed that the larger tour boats, who should be definitely the most aware of their wake, they just don't really care and they plow right by you.
Stuart, thank you for sharing that and certainly that concern. Melanie, those tour boats out there, there's a lot of them, Stuart says.
Definitely, and there are some that, two in particular I can think of, that are jet boats. Mm-hmm. And so what they do to make a thrilling ride for their passengers is to zoom down the river or up the river and slam on the brakes. So people inside get very wet, or certain people do. And that's part of the thrill of the ride. But yes, if they're not paying attention to kayakers or canoers, that would be very dangerous and unpleasant.
I still don't know how that became a thing where you jet up the river and then slam on the brakes and then all your passengers have the, I guess it's for the thrill of it, but I'm just like, how did this become a thing?
I don't know, but I will tell you that I once took a friend of mine on his birthday on that ride, hoping that, I knew he didn't know that that's what they did, that they stopped and got you all wet. So I thought it would be funny for him to get wet. Well, Not everyone in the boat gets wet, just certain people, just depending on where they stop and, you know, the weather and such. So guess who got soaking wet? Me, my friend.
Oh, dear.
And that is one. And if you choose to go on those boats, I will also say one tip is bring extra clothes or a towel or something, because if you are one of the people that gets very wet, when you get out, it can be very chilly and obviously unpleasant if you're soaking and if you plan to do other things in the Dells for that day. So, yeah, definitely take a change of clothes and a towel.
Let's go to Lester in West Bend. Hi, Lester.
Hi. I'm a coin-op collector. I collect coin-operated things. And one of the things I'm looking for at the Dells is unique coin-operated items. And there's a gypsy, an old fortune teller, that was at the Dells on the main strip, and they have a lot of old arcades and unique things like that. And I'm looking for any photographs, any provenance or history on that fortune teller. If you know of how to dig it up or how to find something that way, where would I go about to find those
that history.
Photographs or history?
Yes, Lester, thank you. Melanie?
There's a man, and I don't have his name at my fingertips, but he works with the H.H. Bennett Museum. I think, oh wait, now it's coming to me, might be David Rambo, but he is the local historian. So if you are able to call the Visitors Bureau and just ask about his contact information, he probably could help you out.
Okay, good tip there. So let's turn to food. I was struck that there is this vegan restaurant, the Cheese Factory, and I was wondering if you'd tell a little bit about its features and its story.
It is a very fascinating place. It originally was located right in the Dells. It now is in Baraboo, but again, that's considered part of their marketing area. But they have delicious vegan food, and it's run by a group. Now I will blank on the name. Let me just see if I can find it here. It is run by a group of people who are affiliated with something called A Course in Miracles, which is a self-study system of spiritual thought. They're not proselytizing or anything like that, but it's students and teachers with this program that run this restaurant, and it has delicious food. Everyone I know that's gone there has loved it. I've eaten there many times. It's top quality for sure. But it is a very interesting history.
We're talking with Melanie Redzicki-McManus. New book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. You can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Alan Hayward travels to the Dells about once a month and would love your recommendations for the best 3 iconic dining spots in the Dells.
Well, definitely Ishnala Supper Club is one that is very famous. It's in Mirror Lake State Park. Boy, there's so many good ones. It's hard. These are not necessarily my favorites because I don't want to ding anyone else, but Monk's is another place that
for burgers.
It's not a fancy place. It's like a supper club, but the original Monk's downtown, you have to go there if you're a fan. And let's see, what else will I say?
And
I really
Ishnala,
like.
Well, I want to stop at Ishnala because the views are magnificent.
Oh, sure.
And I understand that every table has a view.
Yes, every table has a view. There are still trees growing through it. The people who built it on a kind of one of the bluffs in the Dells Rocky Formation. So it's perched over the lake. Like I said, trees are growing through it. It's just a place like no other, truly.
No.
Yeah, it's up three, so I'm just going to sneak in one more. This High Rock Cafe, great food. It's on a nice spot in downtown Dells that has several floors. So speaking of views, if you get on top, you can watch the people watch while you eat your food. It's kind of a melding of cuisine from all over the U.S. that the two owners had experience. They brought some flavors back from their experience cooking across the U.S. And that's another spot that maybe doesn't get as much notice as some of the others, but food is really good there.
And there's also buttermilk donuts at Paul Bunyan's Cook Shanty.
Yes.
If you're there for a breakfast, what should we check out at Paul Bunyan's?
Again, like you said, you have to have those buttermilk donuts. I actually hadn't heard about Paul Bunyan's in my early days of covering the Dells. And somebody wrote on my Facebook page, you know, what? You've never mentioned Paul Bunyan's. And I thought, okay, I better check this out. And those donuts are phenomenal. They make them fresh every morning. There can be a line way down the street if we don't get there right away. But they do sell them in some other spots. And even if you don't get them when they're still warm, they are still good.
Melanie,
and if you need more, go ahead.
I'm just going to jump in here. Melanie Redzicki, yes. McManus, author of the new book called 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. You can share what's on your Dells bucket list, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Dells Visitors and Convention Bureau says more than 4 million people flock to this vacation and resort community each year. A new book, it explores the area's natural beauty and the range of attractions. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, your stories. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Melanie Redzicki McManus is author of the new book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. Melanie, you write about the New Life Lavender and Cherry Farm. What is a visit like there?
It is a really lovely place. You can go to this lavender and cherry farm and take a tour around the lavender fields. If you're lucky enough to go during blooming season, which is mid-June to mid-July, obviously, it's even more gorgeous. It smells good. But the owners will take you through the lavender fields on a horse-drawn wagon or tractor-drawn, depending on the day, and tell you all about the property, how they got started, which was somewhat recently. And then they have a store and a restaurant, so you can buy all sorts of wonderful products made with lavender and have some of their famous lavender cherry pie, which I highly recommend. So that is one of the more novel places to go in the Dells area.
Is it a pick your own for cherries? Do you know?
No, and actually now that we talk about the cherries, they started with lavender and cherries, and the cherries trees did not grow well. So they have cherries, and they still incorporate them along with the lavender, but they're actually just growing the lavender now.
Okay, good to know. In terms of cheese, you mentioned Market Square cheese and Carr Valley cheese. What is special about these cheese shops?
Of course, cheese is great in Wisconsin, and we have to have a lot of it. Market Square has a huge variety of cheeses and sausages and other products from all over the state. So that place offers a wonderful selection. Carr Valley is run by a fourth generation master cheesemaker, Sid Cook, and his place is well known across the state. He has a lot of award-winning cheeses. So his shop just sells his products, but it's very worth a stop there because he has a lot of wonderful products. And if you're not averse to taking a short drive, you can go, I forget if it's maybe a half hour up the highway. And another one of his cheese factories is open for tours if you're there on the days that they're making their cheese. So that's another option.
You can kind of make your own cheese tour, it sounds like.
Yes, you can.
Let's go to Laura Lee in Eau Claire. Laura Lee, what attraction would you like to bring up?
The International Crane Foundation and the Aldo Leopold Foundation are both outside Baraboo. And the International Crane Foundation there's nothing like it in the world. They have mating pairs of each of the 15 species of crane there that you can see from May through October. They do great research all over the world on crane habitat and working with cranes, recovering the crane populations, trying to save the ones that are endangered. They have a prairie that you can hike there as well. And then, of course, Aldo Leopold is world famous conservationist as well.
Laura Lee, thank you so much for these contributions. Melanie, how do these natural conservation fit into the Dells?
The Dells began as a tourist destination because of its natural beauty. And it's really important, I think, for people to understand that and kind of immerse themselves in the beauty, because it's not, the Dells is not just about water slides. Those are great and fun, and I like going on them too, but it would be wonderful if visitors could take time to do both and appreciate all of the natural beauty and the glacial history. It's the glacier, melting glacier, that sculpted the Dells formation. So you can learn a lot about our state if you take some time to explore the natural beauty.
You write about a few different things to do at the longest, deepest canyon in the state, Lost Canyon. Speaking of natural beauty, what is the history of Lost Canyon?
Again, another feature from the glacier, but it is just notable because it's so small and narrow, and horses have been taking people through on wagons for decades now. So it's something that's unique in the state, and it's definitely worth a visit.
You recommend zip lining tours, including one that takes people over the Lost Canyon. Can people go zip lining at the Dells in the winter?
Yes, you can. Several of the zip lines are open year round, and that is definitely a different experience. If you've done zip lining, most people, I would assume, have done it in the summer months, but there's nothing like a winter zip to really get your senses going and to appreciate our winter weather.
We have Melanie Redzicki-McManus, new book, 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. You can join in with your contributions, your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. Jim is here from Elroy. Jim, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I was in the Dells a few weeks ago, and I went past a place, it looked like an Aztec temple. It's called the Lost Temple. Do you know anything about that?
The Lost Temple in the Dells, adventure, family fun. Melanie, what is it?
It's an unusual attraction. It's hard to explain. It's kind of like the Upside Down White House, where a guide leads you through, and there's sort of a made-up story about lost treasure. It's really difficult to explain going through there. I would say maybe not my favorite attraction, but people might really enjoy it.
It's like a walkthrough attraction. Would that be a way to describe it?
Right, with a guide, and they talk about, I think it's Mayan history, and there's a made-up story about like an explorer who found these treasures and things like that.
So, you say the Dells is also home to the largest floating water park. It sits on top of a lake in an adventure park called Land of Natura. Can you paint us a picture of what this water park looks like?
Yes, it's very new. It opened this summer. Two brothers whose family have long been involved in the Dells created it to try and put more of a focus on nature. So there's a naturally filtered lake, no chlorine like, you know, in the water parks, with water slides going in it. It sits on a little piece of the Wisconsin River, so you can actually go down on a sandy beach. You can kayak from there if you'd like. There's hiking trails, there's biking trails. They're continually adding to it too, since it just opened up. It's going to be, there's several phases to it. You can take a walk on like a swaying bridge that's strung between trees. It's really a lovely place, and it's very original. There's nothing else like it in the Dells. And then the floating water park, that piece of it in the naturally filtered lake, in addition to the slides, they have this inflatable water park, which I kind of liken to that Ninja Warrior, American Ninja Warrior, whatever that show is, yeah. Because you kind of jump from obstacle to obstacles. And if you fall, you might fall in the lake. And it's just, again, nothing like I've seen in the Dells before. I would encourage everyone to check that out as well.
I was surprised that Noah's Ark dates back to 1979. And I'm just wondering, do water parks keep reinventing themselves?
They do. You know, the Dells as a whole keeps reinventing itself. Hmm. Most of the water parks add a new major ride every couple of years. Sometimes they take down other ones. But when I started first covering the Dells, they had just started the indoor water park phase. And I remember going to one and it had just two little slides and maybe a water spray. And we thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And now, of course, their indoor water parks are 10 times the size. Then there was a phase with spas. And then there was a phase when the condos were built. And now the Dells is kind of hearkening back to nature and trying to get a little more artsy and upscale. So it's just fascinating to watch its evolution.
I would imagine, too, the competition is pretty fierce to keep pace with your competitors in that particular industry and also to keep retail alive. What do you find there?
Retail is an interesting thing. The Dells for many years was maybe 20 years ago or so was known to have a lot of T-shirt shops and souvenir shops and fudge shops and not much else. So they've really been working on trying to get a more upscale options for shopping. And that it's still a work in progress, but there are some nice shops you can visit. And if you know where to look and if you take your time, you can find some gems there. But we'll see what happens with that down the road.
The book is called 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. Author Melanie Redzicki-McManus, our guide, and you can join the discussion. Call in with a question, share your experiences in the Dells, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin Dells has been attracting tourists for more than 150 years. A new book explores the range of offerings through time. Melanie Redzicki-McManus is author of 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. And you can join the discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Paul in Rome, Wisconsin. Paul, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me on your show. Really enjoyed a morning show.
Thank you.
One of the best places that I've ever eaten, and I've gone there many a time, and I live in the town of Rome, which is 60 miles north up Highway 13 from the Dells, the Wally's House of Embers specializes in ribs and that, and I think Marco Bois, a family member, might still be the chef down there. Always celebrated some excellent birthdays down there. And used to be that grandma, there was a grandmother there that played one or the other of the different pianos inside of Wally's House of Embers. Their baby grands too. And had the opportunity to get up and sing "Let Me Call You Sweetheart" at the time, and my grandma knew them all. She knew them all by heart, and I'm just lucky I owned a player piano as a young man.
Oh, what a memory! Yes, Paul, thank you. A traditional supper club there, Melanie.
Yes, it is definitely one of the local favorites. They have some themed private dining areas like the Omar Sharif and Humphrey Bogart rooms. And as the caller said, they're definitely known for their barbecued ribs and other offerings.
Paul, thanks for the call. And Jim emailed recommending Mirror Lake State Park. Jim says it is really great for cross-country cross-country ski trails. It's really good for all levels of skiers. So there is another natural offering there, Melanie.
Yes, there's actually three state parks right in the area, the Muir Lake State Park, Devil's Lake that we talked about earlier, and Rocky Arbor. Rocky Arbor is very small, but it has some hiking trails that are just beautiful, again, showcasing some of those sandstone rock formations.
Your book mentions Wizard Quest, so that is a hard turn there from natural beauty, I understand. But this is a game that is recommended for older kids and adults. What is it?
Oh, Wizard Quest, they just reinvented themselves, and it's a very fascinating place. The family that owns it created all of these magical fairies and figurines themselves. And you get a handheld kind of iPad computer device, and you solve various quests. They ask you questions, and you have to go through various lands of fire and ice and things like that with these magical creatures and trees. And there are some things written down, some puzzles. It's kind of hard to explain. There are, sometimes you might be going down a slide that's hidden somewhere. But it's very interesting. They do have an easier version for kids who are a little younger, but it's definitely more, maybe say middle school and above.
Okay.
And the fans are very rabid. They love this come back again and again.
That's what I was going to say. Once you do it once, would you do it again? Would it be a different experience?
Yes, because you can't, I believe the timing, when you go in, you get the device for maybe 2 or 3 hours, and there's no way you could solve all or go through all these quests in one visit. There's just no way. I tried, and I wasn't even close. And you do get kind of hot running, or no, you're not running around, but you can get kind of warm in there. So if you're coming in the winter with a heavy coat, maybe don't have the heavy coat with you. But yeah, and there's like mirrored rooms that are hidden behind doors you have to find, press the right button to get in. It's very enjoyable.
Okay, so the other attraction with Quest in the name is Magic Quest. Are they related at all?
Not at all. Wizard Quest is, that's the only one in the world. It was created by that local family. Magic Quest, there are other Magic Quest locales. And this one is geared toward the young kids. So it's kind of near the Great Wolf Lodge Resort. And it's geared again toward maybe 7 and younger. So very easy quest that young kids can participate in.
What should we do and where should we go if we want to take in the circus heritage in the Dells and in Baraboo?
Baraboo is definitely the spot. Most people know about Circus World, or many people know about Circus World, which showcases when Baraboo was the winter headquarters for the Ringling Brothers Circus. So you can go there, see circus performances, learn a lot about circus history, but it's more than that. The Ringling Brothers were in Baraboo for quite a number of years, and so they have some of their old mansions you can tour or even stay overnight in. It's very great place. There's even a brewery attached to one Ringling home where they were making the beer. They found the Ringling Brothers, an original Ringling beer recipe under the floorboards when they were renovating the home. And so they make the original Ringling Brothers beer in their brew pub.
What a discovery. What is your favorite activity in the Dells? What do you gravitate to?
Well, if we're talking nature, definitely going either on the Ice Age Trail or in some of the state parks or on the river. If it comes to more of a water park kind of activity, I'd have to think about that. Although I do have a soft spot in my heart for that Trojan horse, just because it's so silly.
Allison wants to know if you visited the Kingsley Bend Indian Mounds and if you could tell us about them.
No, that's something I have not heard about.
And apparently they extend down the slopes of a hill to the Wisconsin River, and they are in that area. So that is something to check out. Let's see here, on Highway 16, a few miles south of the Dells. So Allison, thank you for that suggestion. I was struck that there is a root beer museum. I had no idea. A public museum devoted to root beer.
There is. Yeah, again, the that's what I love about the Dells is you never know what you're going to find there. There is indeed a museum devoted to root beer. The front part of it is a little shop where you can order root beer floats or just buy various cans of root beer soda. And then in the back, if you pay a small fee, they have a small exhibit of like mascots of famous root beer types like A&W, things like that.
All those root beer fans that they're trying to attract, right, coming through the Dells. So if a person or a family visits the Dells for just a weekend, what should they absolutely do on their to-do list?
If you want the classic Dells experience, a duck ride is definitely in order. Going to Noah's Ark, I would say, is another must do. And I would make sure to get on the river in some fashion, whether you take a boat tour, whether you just go to, there's a small public beach where you can just sit on the beach, wade into the water, but get some kind of experience on the river and where you can see those Dells formations up close.
So, truth be told, how many of the 100 things in your book have you done?
Truth be told, I actually have done almost all of them. There are a few things that I have not, including golfing, just because I'm not a golfer, unless you're counting mini golf as golfing. So those recommendations, I relied on my golfing expert friends to tell me about. But no, I have done just about everything.
And you've done them through the years, I would imagine, that, you know, here and there. So what is next on your Wisconsin Dells bucket list? What would you like to do next, outside of golfing, of course?
Well, I have to check out now the Kingsley Mound, that what the caller mentioned, and some of these other places. But, I like to go back every time and see. There's always something new. You know, things open, things close. Just find the latest shop, retry adventures maybe I haven't tried more recently. There's a jet boat I would like to try riding. I would like to try some more of the options at a place called Vertical Illusions. I have not sampled them all yet. So the possibilities are endless, really.
Vertical Illusions, what is that?
They have zip lines, but they also have various guided tours, and it's at a locale a little bit north of the Dells. And they also have wintertime zips.
Okay, so you think you want to do a wintertime zip? That's what I'm kind of hearing here.
I've done one, but yes, I would like to do another one, even though I am afraid of heights. But I figure you have to challenge yourself. And again, because I like to write a lot about the Dells, I feel like it's my duty to try everything there is.
Oh, Melanie, thank you so much for joining us and taking on this tour.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Melanie Redzicki McManus is author of the new book called 100 Things to Do in the Wisconsin Dells Before You Die. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snowboarder Nick Baumgartner of Iron River, Michigan, grew up miles from the Wisconsin border, and he's schooled in the roller coaster of emotions as a four-time Olympian, coming up short of the podium and then winning gold in mixed snowboard cross at the Beijing Olympic Games in 2022. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, A Humble Beginning, Olympic Dreams, and the Power in Getting Back Up. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
You dedicate the book to all the youpers and talk about being filled with youper grit when times get tough. What does it mean to be from the Upper Peninsula, the UP?
Oh, it's just, it's an area that I cherish. I mean, it's, we call it paradise, but it's just an amazing place. And people work a lot harder from there. We think, and I think that comes from just having to fight for all the opportunities. We have less opportunities than the big city kids do. And it just takes a little bit more. No one's going to give us an opportunity. We have to fight for that and we have to work for that. But I think that makes us stronger in the long run. And it sets us up for success.
Is that why you call yourself a blue-collar Olympian? Can you explain that distinction?
So blue-collar Olympian is, it goes back to, like, I had to fund this dream. I didn't come from a background that allowed me to have the funds to go out and go to academies and go to these training facilities to do this. I had to find a more creative way to do it. And my goal was always to be a professional snowboarder. And the definition of a professional snowboarder is someone who gets paid to snowboard. So I had to be a little more creative. I found a job in Wisconsin as a union concrete laborer. And that allowed me to work long hours all summer long, making tons, very good money for a young kid. And then when the winter months came and it got too cold to pour concrete, we were laid off and then we could draw unemployment. So with a little creativity, I was able to get paid to snowboard. And it just it made it better for me. It's my favorite part because I had to fight for it. If I didn't find a job and find a trade that allowed me to do this, it wouldn't have been possible for me.
You also have had to find sponsors along the way and for people to help fund you as well. And you have said that it feels like you have to really be a little bit of a sales pitch. Can you talk about that aspect of sponsorships and what it involves?
Yeah, you definitely have to be turned into a salesperson. And throughout my whole career, I've had to find creative ways to do that in the sense that snowboard cross, what we do, doesn't get a lot of support from the industry of snowboarding. So I had to find ways to find support outside of the industry. So for me, being from the Upper Peninsula, one of my number one sponsors is Ponzi, and they're a Finnish logging company with their North American headquarters in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And it's just because the number one industry where I live is logging. So I found someone that shared that same kind of stuff and that passion. And a lot of my friends and a lot of the people that I went to school with went on to start their own forestry and logging companies. And so that's how I was able to gain a relationship with these people. And they're just super passionate about being able to help me with what I'm doing. And they want to give me an opportunity. And it's been incredible. And I have another company, which is a hometown company, Crist Oil. They have gas stations throughout all of northern Wisconsin. And it's just finding people that kind of share my same story and want to help and want to be a part of my legacy. And it's just finding that creativity and not being afraid to ask people. I think sometimes people are afraid to go out there and ask for things. And I've found that by asking people for stuff, I've gotten to do some pretty amazing things throughout my career. Things like racing trucks professionally all over the country, racing professionally in Mexico's Baja Peninsula. Gotten to do some cool things because I wasn't afraid to ask and to reach out to people.
We're talking with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, your son Landon, born when you were 22, and you dedicate the book as well to him. Can you describe, does Landon travel with you now that he's older? How do you incorporate family into your dream?
Yeah, well, I think my dream doesn't happen at all without the birth of my son. I was 22 years old. I was a child myself, and I was immature. I didn't know what the world was about. Mm-hmm. And I was more focused about me and what I wanted and what I needed. And I think by having a son and making it bigger than myself, I needed to not only provide for this kid at this point, but I needed to lead by example and show him what's possible. If you're willing to dream big and you're willing to outwork everybody. And without that, I just don't know that I would have the longevity. I think I would have went into this with just the wrong attitude, and it wouldn't have worked out. So by having my son, it's been unbelievable. I haven't been able to travel with him a bunch to a lot of races, but my first race he got to come to was in 2011. He got to come out to the X Games. And I found out very fast that when he's on the bottom of the hill, I race way better. And I actually, right before he showed up, it was 12 days before the X Games, I was training in Copper Mountain, Colorado, and I crashed and I broke my collarbone. Mm. I had to get 15 screws and a plate put in 12 days before the race. And everyone counted me out and thought that, all right, there's no way this guy's going to be a threat. And but they didn't know that my son was going to be at the bottom. And I went on and to win 12 days after surgery, to win the biggest race of my life at that point. And it all had to do with having my son at the bottom, and just no one was going to beat me to the bottom to my son. There's no chance.
There's so much grit in your story, and it makes me wonder about those young years growing up with three older brothers and how, you know, everything was a competition. How did the competitiveness between you and your siblings motivate you early on and then kind of touch you throughout your career?
Well, I think my brothers were extreme athletes in everything they did. They were so good and so successful that they set the bar so high on how to get that success. Mm-hmm. by outworking people and by fighting for what you wanted. And it showed me how to act. But more importantly, I wanted to beat my older brothers in something at some point. They were so good. And when you fast forward to high school, their senior year of high school got the most athletic in their class, as well as the best defensive player on the football team. I didn't get either of those things. So it kind of put a chip on my shoulder, and it made me work harder and fight for something. I wanted to prove that I was better than them at something. And I think it took till I was 40, coming home with a gold medal in snowboarding, to prove that I was the best snowboarder in the family. So I finally accomplished that goal after many years of trying.
Your parents also had three strict rules for the kids to follow growing up. One was that chores were mandatory. What else did they really, you know, passionately instill in you in terms of rules of the house?
Well, definitely you had to work. It was funny. Anytime a family member, a friend of the family, or one of my parents' relatives needed help, whether it be tilling a field for the farm and picking rocks or baling hay, they were always like, oh man, you guys need help. I got kids. We'll send them over.
we were never
expected to get paid either. It was just to do the right thing, to help out our neighbors when they needed help. And it just instilled in us just that sense of helping out when we can, and that work ethic. And it's just, I'm very fortunate. We didn't grow up with a ton of money growing up, but we were rich in so many other aspects. My parents were foster care providers. My sister, we adopted when she was two and I was three. And just having all these kids in and out, just the lessons that we learned throughout all that. And my parents, man, I couldn't have grown up or asked for better parents than I had. And it's a big part of my success, just the way that they raised us and the way that they showed us that, like I said, chores were necessary. And if you weren't doing a sport, you had to get a job. So we were always fighting to get into the next sport, for the next sport. And to me, that's very important because, yes, you learn a lot in the classroom, but the lessons that I learned on the athletic field or on the wrestling mat, those lessons have helped me be successful in every aspect of my life. It teaches you about how to overcome adversity, how to deal with failure, and how to get back up when you get knocked down. And I think that's why you'll see so many lessons like that throughout my book. And every time I get knocked down, I get back up. And it was from those lessons that I learned in sport and through my family.
Nick Baumgartner is a snowboarding Olympic gold medalist. We explore his new memoir. It's called Gold from Iron. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn life lessons and how to chase a dream from a veteran Olympian snowboarder who proudly hails from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, minutes from the Wisconsin border. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick, we heard from Jack and Madison called in, and Jack says it's great for a blue-collar Midwesterner to make it in sports, and reminds Jack of the Milwaukee Bucks winning the NBA championships in 2021. What advice do you have for Midwesterners or anyone from that background, Jack wonders, who are aspiring for sports greatness?
I think don't believe the excuses. I mean, we can always come up in even in our own heads of excuses of why we don't have the opportunity to do this. One, we don't come from the right place. One, we're too old, or we don't have the funds to be able to make this happen. There's always a way. There's always a way. If you dig in hard enough and you're willing to outwork people, there's always a way to make it happen. And we get one chance at life. I mean, why not fight for it? If you do everything you can, I mean, if you do everything you can, that's possible to get what you want and you fall short, it's okay. You can live with that. You've done everything you can. There's no shame in that. But when you cut corners and you believe the excuses and you don't go out there and fight for what you want and then you fall short, that'll haunt you for the rest of your life. So go out there and get what you want out of life.
You also recommend putting pen to paper and writing down your goals. Why do you suggest that?
Well, I mean, I've read books and I've seen lessons and I've listened to speakers, and they always say writing down your goals is so important, because just by writing it down and looking at it over and over again, you're 40% more likely to achieve that goal. There's nothing in life that will give you a free 40% that easily. Just by writing it down, you 40% more likely to succeed. Come on. I mean, that's so easy to just write it down, look at it, put it on your refrigerator, put it in your bathroom, put it places where you will see this. And you got a way better chance for sure.
Okay. So we're going to talk about a coach at Copper Mountain in Utah who really helped you make a change that catapulted your career. Can you explain how one coach helped you so much?
Yeah. So when I got into snowboarding, I'm from basically northern Wisconsin, but right across the border in the Upper Peninsula. And there was no like blueprint on how to do this. I didn't know any professional snowboarders from the area. I didn't know any mentors that I could ask and figure out how to do this. I kind of just ran into it like, here I am. I don't know what I'm doing, but here I am. And that was good, and it was great because I took a chance, but I did need some knowledge and I needed some coaching. And I had a coach, Nate Park. He definitely, he found a way to break it down to me and explain to me the things that I was doing wrong, or why these movements or these different things that I needed to learn, why I needed to learn them. And just by having it broke down and having someone really explain it to me so that in a manner that I could understand it, it was like a light bulb went off and I was like, oh, well, that's why I need to do that. And once I understood and once I figured out like what the reason was, and it changed everything. Then I was willing to work harder for it. I was willing to do the right thing rather than just going out there and just doing something. I mean, that's a great way to start, to just go in there, but you got to learn how to figure it out. And surrounding yourself with people that know what's going on and how to do it is the best way to get that success faster.
It sounds like you also soak in information, especially about technique and other things. You just soak it in almost in an extremely active way. How do you acquire knowledge and then apply it as a snowboarder?
Well, for me, my biggest thing when I got into it, I had all the drive in the world and the passion. I wanted to win it. And I think that's like something, sometimes you can't coach that. But when you can find someone that has that, you can teach them everything else. So for me, I wanted it so bad. And I, at first, before I had my coach, I didn't know like what to do. So what I did is I picked out the guys that were the best. that had already figured it out and knew what they were doing. And then I tried to emulate them. I was like, if I just do what they're doing, I'm going to get better. When I tried to do a turn, I wanted to look like a kid that ended up being my teammate for many years, Graham Watanabe, a three-time Olympian. I was like, this guy has the best form I've ever seen. If I can just try to look like that when I'm riding, it's going to be better. And I started to pick things up. And just by looking at the people that had already figured it out, asking questions, it's so important to find people that know how to do it and ask questions. But when you ask questions to people that really know what's going on, man, it short tracks everything and it gets you a little shortcut to the top. Obviously, there is no shortcuts. I shouldn't say shortcut because it's a bad word to use. There is no shortcuts. Hard work is always the answer. But by talking to people, you don't waste that energy. You're more efficient with what you're doing.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner in conversation about his new memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Nick, you meet who you call Mr. Swixguy and learn about waxing your boards. And I'm wondering first, you know, how many boards do you carry with you around the world?
When I travel now, so at this race, I have seven snowboards with me.
Seven race boards,
and then one free ride board. So when we're not on course and we're just having fun, because it's important for us to not just always do the sport and the training, and that you need to keep the love for it. So I make sure that I have a board that's fun to ride and just out there and having fun. But we have different boards for different conditions, different grinds on the base of our boards. That's a structure that they put on the bottom for different conditions. So yeah, we travel with a lot of boards and it does get difficult. But going back to what you said, the Swix guy. Yeah, I showed up to a race again at the beginning. I just showed up not knowing what I was doing. And I showed up to this big race. It was my first televised race in Crested Butte, Colorado. And I see all these guys like rubbing stuff on their boards and doing all these things to the bottom of their board. And I was like, oh, crap. I have no idea what they're doing. And that looks very important. And luckily there was a guy from the company Swix that was, he was selling and pushing this paste that he had that they would put on the bottom. So I went up to him again to give myself a chance. And I asked him questions. I was like, hey man, what do you got there? And can I use some of that? And luckily he had these samples that he was giving people and he handed me some, and then he told me what to do. So I start working on my board, and then I get in the heat, and it's funny because all the people that were there, they're like, dude, you're in big trouble. You're racing against one, that guy right there won last year. That guy won the year before, and that guy next to him is his brother. So you're in big trouble. And I was like, oh, all right, well, here we go. I'm going to go do my best. And luckily the Swix guy gave me that sample stuff. And I went out there and I won that first heat. And when I got back to the top, he grabbed my board and he said, you are not touching this thing anymore. And then he went and started putting the stuff on that all these guys were putting on, the better stuff. And it just leveled the playing field. And it gave me an opportunity to be successful. Because without that, there's no chance that I would have been able to. My skill and my ability and my determination would not have been enough. I needed to have the same chance as everyone else. And luckily, this guy was willing to do it.
One other thing that has really taken snowboarding to the next level is technology and like drones looking at courses and what lines to follow. What new things are going on there?
So for us, we've always had this like technical advantage. We had a coach for many years that was just like a super nerd about this kind of stuff, about giving us that technical advantage. He actually invented a video system that allowed us as a team and no other team. I think the teams are slowly starting to get this now, but we've already had it for 15 years, where he would film from up on the edge of the mountain way up high so he could get the entire course. And as he's filming, as soon as he gets done, it goes through this Wi-Fi system. He sets up what looks like a little weather station, and the other teams are looking at him like he's crazy. Like, what's that weather system? It was just a Wi-Fi system that would allow him to shoot that video from his camera bounce it off of the Wi-Fi system and throw it to iPads that were at the top of the course.
So you can exactly see what your teammates and other racers are doing. Talking about a new memoir from Nick Baumgartner on being an Olympian, what it's like. You can call in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Olympic snowboarding gold medalist Nick Baumgartner pushes the limits on top of mountains. The Michigan native's new memoir, Gold from Iron, recounts his journey to four Olympics and the community in the Upper Peninsula who rally around him. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jean in Wales. Jean, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Hey, Nick, we're so proud of you. I'm a Youper from the UP, been there forever, and have followed your journey from the very, very beginning. So I'm on my sixth copy of your book that my family all wanted.
Oh, Jean, thank you so much for calling in. Nick, you can feel the warmth from Jean and so many others. You know, when you come back or came back from the Olympics, you had a huge parade that escorted you. You know, how was that parade and how was that reception?
It was unbelievable. So I landed into Green Bay, Wisconsin. I walked out and I just hear chants of USA, USA, the Olympic music playing in the background. And I walked out to just so many friends of mine that are from the Green Bay area. And then my son surprised me. So I got to see him, hug, lots of tears, lots of high fives. And then we stayed the night there so that I could come into town the next day. And my favorite thing was being able to drive through these community. I think Pembine, Wisconsin was the first one that had people spread out throughout the town. And then Niagara, and then we crossed into Michigan, and then through Iron Mountain back into Florence, Wisconsin, and all the way home. And just seeing so many people willing to stand out in the freezing cold and cheering for us. But being able to have my son there made it so special. And just to, I mean, there was a lot of tears happening. And then when we got to Iron River, it was crazy. There was people from all over the Midwest that had driven up to be a part of that parade. And rather than drive through the town, I decided to get out and walk and be able to walk over and hug people. And anytime I saw someone that even had a little bit to do with my journey, the tears would start flowing and the hugs would happen. Mm. And that's why, I mean, it's someone like Gene that makes me so proud to represent these people. It's just amazing people that when you do something good and you're from a small community, everyone will rally behind you. And it's been the story of my journey for sure.
Let's pick up on the tears, because you gave dozens of speeches after winning the gold at age 40, and you shed tears in front of your audiences. I'm wondering how you deal with emotions and the raw emotions you feel, whether it's right after a race in front of news cameras or in front of your audiences in the UP.
It's just one thing I can say is ever since I represented not only my country, my family, but my whole community back in the Midwest at the first Olympics in 2010, when I walked out into opening ceremonies, it changed me as a human being. I went from thinking I was this young, tough guy to a very emotional. And now if I go and watch like kids' sporting events and I see like whatever age it is, maybe even an 8-year-old make a basket, everyone's cheering and having a good time. And I'm in the corner crying. And it's brought out those emotions in me. And I think it's very important. Emotions are good. And to be able to share them as this masculine athlete is, I think it's important for people to see that. And it's not like a trick or anything. I just, when I start talking about my story and the things I've gotten to do and fighting through those challenges to get to that point where I finally won that medal, the tears just come out naturally. And I'm happy to share it. I'm not embarrassed by it in any way, shape or form. I think it's important. And sometimes I can't finish my sentences, which makes it a little tough to do a speech, but it's awesome. And I think it's that raw and that honest emotion that people want to see and people should see.
I want to explore how you found the Upper Peninsula a really perfect training ground for an Olympian, you know, physically and mentally. You write about how Dustin Brancio popped into your life. Can you talk about that training and what you did in the UP?
So, like I mentioned before, the Upper Peninsula, we don't have the same opportunities as everyone else. You go to these big cities, and they have these sports specific training facilities with just the top of the line, the technology, everything is there for you to be successful, and we don't have that all over the Upper Peninsula. And to be honest, the only place I could find that was in Marquette, Michigan. And I was very fortunate that Dustin Brancio at Advantage Sports Training in Marquette reached out to me and he said, "Hey, I think we can help you with your training." And I was like, "All right, here's a guy, a fellow Uper that really wants to be a part of this." And not only that, but he was a football player. He's a collegiate football player who was trying to make it to the NFL. And that was my first dream. I went to college to play football. Unfortunately, found out that I was too immature for college and I needed to take a break. And that's when I switched to the snowboarding. But this guy understood me and he got me. And by going up there and training with him, at 40 years old, you can't just do the same old stuff you were doing. You got to be more efficient in what you're doing. So with his program, I was able to be efficient. And if, say, I showed up and I was tired, we had technology and we had eyes and computers reading the speed at which I was pushing the weights. So if I was tired and exhausted, I just didn't do it because I needed to do another set. We knew when, all right, you're tired, you need to take a break, we need to change this and do something different. And that was the first time that I experienced that when I was back home in the UP. And it was, I think it was crucial to my success at the Olympics.
Meanwhile, living out of your van with your dog Oakley, why did you decide to do that?
So, I mean, when we say a blue-collar Olympian, I needed to find a way to not have to pour concrete all summer long because, one, I needed to be able to train more. And when you're working 12-hour days, it's hard to fit it in. And then I'm beating the crap out of my body, my hands, my back. I was just hurting myself. So I needed to find a way. So my brother's a contractor out in Aspen, Colorado. So I went out there and I worked for him for a month in the spring. And that made me enough money to not have to work all summer long. And, but I didn't have money to go up to Marquette and spend $200 a night staying in a hotel. So I had this van that I used for construction and I just slid a bed into the back and we parked it anywhere we could find a place to do it because I saved so much money being able to do that. By staying in the van, I wasn't spending $600 to $800 a week in hotel rooms. I was just spending the gas money going up and it just made it so much more feasible. And then I would go straight from the gym to the mountain bike trails. And I think people don't understand that. I mean, I've been all over the world and I've mountain biked at a lot of places. And the mountain bike trails that we have in the Upper Peninsula are world class. And it was important for me because mountain biking is the closest thing I can get to what I do on sport. So it's the best cross training I can do. And by going up and staying the night in Marquette and working out 4 days a week, it gave me that opportunity to just set myself up for the closest training and the closest replication to what I do on the snow.
I smiled when you jump into Lake Superior at the end of a hard day working out.
Right. I mean, Lake Superior is freezing cold and people talk about, oh, it's so cold. How do you go swimming? But Lake Superior will heal you if you jump into that cold water. And it's very important. And I think now you see so many people starting to do these cold plunges. Well, that's the biggest cold plunge in the world.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner, our guide to the Olympics, What It Takes, new memoir, Gold from Iron. And you can join in with questions, 800-642-1234. Okay, Nick, truck racing, what the heck got into you? What was this period where you went into truck racing?
So it's funny, like I started racing snowboards because of people like Sean Palmer and seeing these other athletes, these extreme athletes doing these amazing things. And for me, lots of people would say, oh, these guys are lucky. They're on TV. They get to do this cool stuff, like Travis Pastrana, Brian Deegan, all these guys. And it was just funny. A lot of them, they made their name in one sport. And then they use that fame to cross over into rally racing. So when I got started into snowboarding, the goal was always to make a name for myself and cross over into auto sports. Well, fortunately, one of the biggest off-road truck racing tracks in the world is in Crandon, Wisconsin. And I had a friend who started racing trucks and asked me to come there and to be the voice in his ear, telling him what was going on around him. And it got me one step closer to that driver's seat. And I was like, I need to do this. And again, I just went out and I started asking people and to my surprise, I started getting yeses. And I was able to race Pro Lights in the, I can't remember what it is now, but it's the Traxxas Torque Series when I was doing it. And I got to race against these guys that paved the way for me and gave me the blueprint, like Brian Deegan, Travis Pastrana. And I got to go out there and do that. And for me, it was a way for me to live on that edge, because when I'm racing snowboards, if it's crazy and things are happening around me, you got to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. And being able to stay at that, bouncing off that rev limiter and just going full speed all the time, I thought that it was going to give me this big advantage. So it was important for me to be able to do that. Plus, it was fun. It was like the craziest thing you've ever done, just pushing on that gas pedal and going as hard as you can. But it allowed me to race all year round, keeping those skills and that all those skills just sharp and ready to go. So when I got back, all my competitors hadn't raced since the last season. Well, I've been racing all summer, so let's go. I'm ready.
And you had a major rollover, and just the dangers of that sport, did that at all impact your snowboarding?
No, and I think you learn that, like when I crash on a snowboard, you get hurt. I broke my back, I broke my collarbone. Mm. I've had some injuries along the way. But in a race truck, you have this thing that's engineered and designed to keep you safe. Yes, accidents can happen and you can get injured. But I've rolled over in trucks. Like, we rolled over in Mexico in the Baja Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I was a passenger at this point. At 80 miles an hour, I rolled 5 times off the freeway. And when we came to a rest, I was like, I'm fine. This is crazy. It was hard to believe. But there's a saying that they say, with age comes the cage. Because you can't take those hits as much. And when I'm on a snowboard, I've found a way to be a little bit better at calculating my risks and not just taking risks just to take them. So I don't crash as much as I used to. But in a race truck, I had all this stuff to protect me. But it was so fun. It was like the coolest thing I've ever gotten to do. And I think when people read this book, they're going to be blown away with the things that I got to do just because I wasn't afraid to ask.
Nick Baumgartner, Olympic gold medalist in snowboarding from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan near the Wisconsin border. New memoir tracing this journey of learning to snowboard as a teenager and then setting his sights on the Olympics, getting there multiple times. Call in with a question. Add your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his new memoir, tracing his journey from a small community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to top the podium at the Beijing Olympic Games. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Susie in Hartford is here. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Kate. I love your show. Nick, it's been so fun to watch your journey. I can't wait to read your book. It's so, all I can say is Niner would be so proud of all the things you're keeping doing. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Nick, that must feel so good to you. Can you talk about where your journey goes from here?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been very fortunate to have such a long career, but as long as I'm having fun and I'm competitive, which kind of go hand in hand, I'm going to continue to do this as long as I can. And now everyone's like, well, why didn't you quit when you were on top? And I was like, well, now there's no pressure. I have the medal. So now I can just have fun and that pressure goes away. And I think when you're just having fun and there's no pressure, you become very dangerous. And even at 44 years old, I think that I have an opportunity to show up. Yes, I'm not going to be super fast at every single track, but when that track suits me and the things line up in my favor, you better watch out. Do not count me out because I'm coming for you. And the fact that I'm still fast and I'm still having fun, it's just, for me, it's like I got plenty of time to get old and to not be able to do this. So if there's even a chance that I can continue to do this, I'm going to do it. And then that journey is going to head towards the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina. My mom's family is all from a small village in northern Italy, and they really want me to be able to, or want to be able to go there. And so I guess there is a little bit of pressure. All my aunts and uncles and my cousins are like, we want to go, so you got to go. And I'm just having fun, and that's what life's about, having as much fun as you can. And like I said, I've been very fortunate to be able to do this, and I'm just going to keep doing it because not only is it fun, but it still gives me those dreams and those goals to set goals and to keep fighting for it and to push my body to see what I'm capable of.
And you're the veteran snowboarder out there. You've seen it all. You've seen so much. And the young snowboarders, they're watching you and looking up to you as that role model for the sport. You know, what do you want the sport to achieve next? Where do you see snowboarding going and what can you do to propel it there?
Well, my biggest thing that I love about being the veteran and the mentor to these younger kids is, it's funny, for the U.S. snowboard team, I think it's very important to have a guy like me on the team because, one, like these younger kids are coming to steal my job. So I work so hard and I make so many sacrifices because the last thing I want to do is show up and look old. And I think a lot of people, as we're aging, can understand where I'm coming from. But on the other side of that, these kids are seeing that I'm pushing that and I'm staying fast. So they're out there pushing themselves and putting in the work, maybe more than they would have with not, because they don't want to lose to somebody that's as old as their parents. That's like not supposed to happen. So if they do, it just, they push me, but then in return, I push them so much harder. And I think it's bringing, one, our team to another level. But I think it crosses across to everybody. No one wants to lose to an older guy, especially someone that's the same age as their parents. So we push this level, and snowboarding is such an amazing sport to me. Some people, we get a bad name, we get a bad rap. People think we're the troublemakers, where they're just, we're, I don't know, the rebels. But we found this sport and we wanted to do it because it's cool, because it's our own thing. And to see how far it's come, every time I look at freestyle snowboarding, the half pipe, slope style, I think like, it can't get any bigger than this. And now people are doing three flips and a half pipe and landing. And every time I think that, can we push this further? We find a way to push it further and to see what's possible. And it's just so cool to watch it, but it's even cooler to have been a part of it for so many years and to push this sport to the levels that it's at.
Another veteran in Lindsay Jacobellis, you winning the gold in 2022 with her, and you write about that friendship, like she's your sister. How did it feel to win that gold together?
Yeah, having a teammate makes it, I think, a lot more special. I would have loved to win the individual one, but I made a mistake and I had to own that. But when you bring a teammate into the thing, and especially for me being partnered with Lindsay, who is the greatest female snowboard cross racer of all time, it takes a little bit of pressure off because I'm pushing as hard as I can because I don't want to let her down. But if I do make a mistake, I've got the goat to make up for it. So it just, it allows some of that pressure to come off, but it also makes it more special because we're doing this together. She's giving everything she have to make sure that I'm successful, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure that she's successful. So it just, it brings our level of riding to another level. And it's just, it's so special to be able to do it together. And for her to be 36 years old and for me to be 40, and to beat the bronze medal went to a 20 and a 22 year old. I mean, that, come on, a 42 year old to a 76 year old combined age. It's crazy. And it just, it was super special. And I think we made a statement at that Olympics.
I want to land on the danger because you discuss snowboarding tracks that you felt were too dangerous for people to ride, especially at Sochi. Why are people allowed to compete on such dangerous tracks?
I think it goes back to just people need to trust the people that are actually risking their lives. We're out there doing everything we can to one, to put on a show, but to push ourselves to be successful in what we're doing. But if we say it's not safe, you need to believe us, and you need to put in the work to make sure that it's safe. Like, we don't want it like super safe. We understand the risk going in. That's what makes our sport so cool. So we don't want it to be easy and have no risk, but we don't want any just ignorant, unsafe things. Like, we want it to be like, I love jumping at the X Games. When I won, we were jumping 130 feet. At 60 miles an hour, which is crazy to most people, but we train for that. And we know that risk when we go in. But it's when we see a problem with a course and they don't listen to us that makes it frustrating. And we've found ways since then. It's like anything, mistakes were made, but we've learned from those mistakes, and now they find ways to listen to us better, to have a communication with the athletes, to the builders, to the coaches, to the organizers. And unfortunately, some lessons need to be learned the hard way. And I think that goes back to my book. Like, I'm so proud of this book and the fact that there's so many young athletes out there that, yes, when you learn things the hard way, it sticks better, and you learn it and it really sticks, but you shouldn't have to learn everything the hard way. Some of us have already done that for you. And so you can read about it and learn and go, okay, all right. He did this and he learned from it. Maybe I don't have to do that.
Oh, Nick, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your journey.
Well, I appreciate it, you guys. And I know I always talk about being so proud and being from the Upper Peninsula, but I live 7 miles from the Wisconsin border.
You have the Wisconsin love as well. Yes. Nick Baumgartner, new memoir, Gold from Iron. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.